Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And with the firestorm around the unverified dossier about Trump and Russia reported on by CNN and released by BuzzFeed, and with Trump refusing to answer a question from a CNN reporter at his news conference as a result, we'll talk on today's program with CNN media correspondent Brian Stelter about the story and about press popularity and press freedom in the Trump presidency. We'll also see why so many visitors to Rikers Island get strip searched on their way in, and why women in New York City have very different experiences when they give birth at different New York hospitals. These are two WNYC investigative reports unveiled this week about the strip searches and about the maternity wards, and we'll take your stories on both as the morning goes on. But we'll begin today with the question, what have we learned after three intensive days of confirmation hearings for Trump nominees? Well, for one thing, we've learned that some of them are pretty willing to disagree with their boss's stated policy positions, whether that's just playing to the hearing or whether it indicates a real exchange of views will take place in the administration remains to be seen. For another, we've learned that one of the biggest proponents for changing the status quo in federal policy might be Dr. Ben Carson, who would run the Housing and Urban Development Department. He wants more private and religious sector involvement in affordable housing, he says, and he wants to take new steps to fight what he calls dependency on subsidized housing. That led him to being asked this question by New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez.
Do you agree that the government should continue to provide rental assistance to the more than 4.5 million low-income households across this country?
I think the rental assistance program is essential. And what I have said, if you've been reading my writings, is that when it comes to entitlement programs, it is cruel and unusual punishment to withdraw those programs before you provide an alternative route.
Ben Carson with Bob Menendez. We pulled various newsworthy clips from the hearings, many of which will sound like disagreement between the nominees and the president-elect who nominated them. We'll get to those. And with me to help understand all this are Charles Bagley, who covers the intersection of politics and real estate for the New York Times, and Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and covers national security generally, and is author of the new book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. So Fred and Charles, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having us.
And Fred, be patient as we do a little housing first here. Charles, what stood out to you about Ben Carson's hearing in terms of what he might want to change as it might affect New York City in particular?
Well, I suppose for a lot of New Yorkers, it was good that he thought rental assistance was essential, quote.
What we just heard in that clip, you mean?
Yes. But I'm not sure, after listening to the hearing, exactly what his priorities will be. And to put it in context, you know, HUD has been retreating from its role in housing across the United States for years. I think they might have hit a high water mark during the Clinton years, and since then, the amount of money that filters down to communities is been cut in half. You know, at one point, he talked about that he had been quoted talking about a 10% across the board cut, and then he later modified that, he said, to 1%. But I'm not sure what programs he'll be promoting. He wants to do a listening tour, go out and particularly to local HUD offices to see exactly what works. In terms of management, he said, well, I don't like the top-down approach, you know, that the people on the ground should be able to tell him what is really happening. But that's sort of a nice gloss, but we don't know exactly what his priorities will be.
How much was he out of his depth as a brain surgeon in a housing interview, in your opinion, and how much did he seem like a quick study who kind of gets this area already?
Well, he seems to have some sensitivity, but housing, particularly housing for the poor, affordable housing, these are enormously complicated issues. Just to give an illustration, you know, even some big-time real estate companies who have built office buildings and own all legions of all kinds of stuff, Tishman Speyer and BlackRock, you know, they bought Manhattan's largest apartment complex for $5.4 billion back in 2006. And they thought, well, we...
That was Stuyvesant Town, right?
Yes. And they said, well, we know real estate, so we ought to know how to run Stuyvesant Town, which was a rent-regulated complex. And, of course, that ran into a wall. It was a disaster financially, and they had to walk away 3 years later. And I think that's just an illustration that just because you do one thing well doesn't mean that you can do all things well. You really got to understand the peculiarities and the impact of what you're doing, and what are the mores and the sort of expectations of the people, and you know, just thinking about public housing in New York City, it's been a disaster as the feds have cut back the revenue flow, and there's had to have been a lot of deferred maintenance, and those buildings are in tough shape, but the money continues to decline, and we're talking about real money anyway.
But that's not up to the HUD secretary, right? That's really up to Congress to allocate money for public housing and other housing programs.
Well, that's true. The question is, what is the HUD secretary going to be championing? What will he tell Congress that the priority should be? What's he going to advocate for? You know, the federal, the HUD money that comes to New York, for instance, comes into a variety of places. I mean, there's Sandy relief. The city expects to get $439 million in disaster relief monies. But there's also $481 million in Section 8 funding. That's 130,000 vent vouchers. That's what we're talking about when we talk about rental assistance. Now, Dr. Carson called that essential. But you know, if they do cut back on those programs, I think that it's almost inevitable that you'll see a further heightening of homelessness, not only in New York City, but in other cities in the country.
Listeners, we'll take our first few questions, if you have any, on the Dr. Carson hearings for Housing and Urban Development Secretary for Charles Bagley. Then we'll go on to the National Security positions, Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, Homeland Security Secretary. That nominee said some interesting things yesterday with Fred Kaplan from Slate. But if anybody listened to any of the Ben Carson hearing or has any question relevant to that, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Charles Bagley, who covers the intersection of real estate and politics for the New York Times. And here's another exchange with Carson. In this case, the questioner is Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. And her main concern here is whether Donald Trump, as a real estate developer, might benefit personally from any of Carson's decisions at HUD.
If you are confirmed to lead HUD, you'll be responsible for issuing billions of dollars in grants and loans to help develop housing and provide a lot of housing-related services. Now, housing development is an area in which President-elect Trump and his family have significant business interests. Can you assure me that not a single taxpayer dollar that you give out will financially benefit the president-elect or his family?
I can assure you that the things that I do are driven by a sense of morals and values. And therefore, I will absolutely not play favorites for anyone.
Dr. Carson, Let me stop right there. I'm actually trying to ask a more pointed question, and it's not about your good faith. That's not my concern. My concern is whether or not among the billions of dollars that you will be responsible for handing out in grants and loans, can you just assure us that not $1 will go to benefit either the president-elect or his family?
It will not be my intention to do anything to benefit any American.
I understand that.
It's for all Americans, everything that we do.
Do I take that to mean that you may manage programs that will significantly benefit the president-elect?
You can take it to mean that I will manage things in a way that benefits the American people. That is going to be the goal.
Ben Carson with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Charles Bagley, what was going on there? Did that have anything to do with housing policy, or was that Elizabeth Warren just using the Ben Carson hearing as a way to needle Trump over his lack of willingness to divest himself of his business holdings?
Well, I think it was probably a lot more needling than policy discussion. I mean, Trump, number one, hasn't been a developer for some time. Number two, when he was a developer, he built luxury condominiums. He did not build affordable housing. He didn't build public housing. So for the most part, he didn't get federal assistance. However, even in building some of these luxury towers like Trump World Tower, he actually sued the city to get tax breaks under the city's housing programs. So you did see where he was getting enormous public assistance to sell apartments that you and I I cannot afford at any time in the near future.
Jeb in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeb.
Hey, Brian, good morning.
And what's your question?
My question is specifically about regulations. HUD is known for a tremendous amount of regulations and keeping landlords in line and improving their properties and protecting the renter's interest. And my family's been involved in long-term housing for 50 years or so in the Boston area. And my dad seems to be excited about Ben Carson because he's going to loosen the regulations and allow our business to become easier and more profitable, but I worry about the bad landlords that maybe don't have the best interest in mind of the renters and use the loosening of regulations to continue to reap the profits, but not improve the living conditions of the people that need it.
What's an example, if you know one, of a regulation that your father would like to see loosened?
Inspections, simple inspections, inspecting less often. Amazing. The schedule of inspections is good. I guess difficult for people who actually run and make a living off it, but it's extremely important. It's a high dollar amount on the inspections. If you don't do them properly, if you don't pass, it costs you a tremendous amount of money. So I could see him rolling that back for the larger, because we're a small business. We're talking 500 to 1,000 units, which is not as big as these, you know, large Tishman companies. But that's a lot of money for them if they're able to inspection quarterly instead of monthly or a different schedule. I could see that being a big giveaway.
And are those inspections an example of where you think bad landlords might be able to get away with more stuff, or would that be other areas?
In my experience, they get away with a lot of stuff now with this inspection the regimen now. I imagine if it's looser, I would just imagine it would continue. It would take longer for the renters to have problems addressed, fixes, the building maintenance, heat, hot water, holes in the wall, you know, all the basic living standards that we all find to be basic in this country. I wonder if you bring back the regulations, wouldn't it just get worse? It's hard now.
Jeb, thank you so much for chiming in on this with such an informed call. We really appreciate it. Please call us again. And Jacob in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, thank you for having me. What I would like to comment on is working 7 years in real estate, handling almost entirely Section 8 tenants, is that in my experience I've seen there are tenants that absolutely require the Section 8. Either they are disabled or they're at full-time jobs, but they need the subsidies to help pay their rent. But then you have another category, which are people who have figured out how to abuse the systems, and they're fully able, but they're living off of the government dollar. And I think that perhaps Mr. Carson is referring to cutting those abusers out of the system.
Is there a way, in your opinion, that he could do that?
Absolutely. It's just about getting the process in order and being organized.
Are you talking about, like, looking more deeply into the finances of applicants for Section 8 vouchers and whether they really are poor enough?
Yeah. I mean, many of those tenants have nice cars or beautiful TVs or whatever they're doing with their money. I'm not sure how you want to investigate it. But they're also taking up the spots because there are only a limited amount of vouchers. So they're taking up the spots of people who would require it.
Uh-huh.
It's terrible to see.
Jacob, thank you for your call. Well, Charles Bagley from the New York Times, who covers the intersection of real estate and politics. Interesting couple of calls there. One concerned about abuse by landlords, one concerned about abuse by tenants.
Yes, and I guess, you know, as I said in the beginning, we still don't know exactly what the priorities will be of Dr. Carson or of the Trump administration when it comes to housing. There is a lot of fear out there that there will be cutbacks and that'll have an effect on many cities in the country. Like I said, HUD's role in public housing has been curtailed continually since the 1990s, and if that's going to accelerate, I think there are plenty of repercussions, and at least one of them is going to be an inevitable increase in homelessness.
Charles Bagley, thank you so much for your insights on what the Ben Carson confirmation hearing might have revealed yesterday. We appreciate it. And now we'll get to the foreign affairs and national security nominees with Fred Kaplan, who covers those areas for Slate. Here is Defense Secretary nominee James Mattis seeming to be much more of a hawk on Vladimir Putin's Russia than Trump is.
Since Yalta, we have a long list of times that we've tried to engage positively with Russia. We have a relatively short list of successes in that regard. And I think right now the most important thing is that we recognize the reality of what we deal with Mr. Putin, and we recognize that he is trying to break the North Atlantic Alliance, and that we take the steps, the integrated steps, diplomatic, economic, military, and the alliance steps, the working with our allies to defend ourselves where we must.
Defense Secretary nominee General James Mattis at his confirmation hearing. And Fred, I'll tell everybody, you wrote a piece on Slate basically endorsing Mattis for his confirmation. Tell me why you like him and tell me how surprised you were by how strong he seemed to be on criticizing Russia there or portraying it as a threat.
Well, I endorsed him, so to speak, in a context, and I've written this before as well. I see Mattis as a restraining influence within the Trump administration, a retired four-star general who might muster the street cred necessary to talk back and perhaps even out-argue the retired three-star general Michael Flynn, who is Trump's national security advisor and who has really, I think it's fair to call them rabid views on the use of force, on the evil of all Muslim nations and Muslims in general. I think Mattis in any other administration would be unacceptable as a Secretary of Defense, in part because, you know, the Founding Fathers wanted civilian control of the military. There's even a law that's been on the books since the Department of Defense was created in 1947 saying that the Secretary of Defense shall not be a military officer who has retired in the last 10 years. That was later revised to 7 years. Mattis retired 4 years ago. The Congress had to pass a waiver allowing him even to be considered for Secretary of Defense. This passed easily with the Senate Armed Services Committee and the full Senate. It's only the second time since the founding of the Department of Defense that this has happened. And it's basically because Mattis is viewed as more of a realist who is not in favor of the unilateral use of military force, who has, you know, like many military officers, actually, great reluctance to enter into war, especially on our own compared with other people in the Trump administration.
And so here's another example from his hearing of where he seemed to set himself up as being a hedge against impulsive actions by Donald Trump. He kind of supports here staying in the Iran nuclear deal.
Sir, I think it is an imperfect arms control agreement. It's not a friendship treaty. But when America gives her word, we have to live up to it and work with our allies.
Were you surprised by that, Fred?
No, I mean, he has said all this in the past. There was actually very little in the way of surprise in this series. I think that the first clip you played about the long list of attempts to engage with Russia over the decades and the short list of successes, I would disagree with that. I think, and again, this I generally agree with him on dealing with Putin, but in general, there's been a pretty decent list of successes, a half dozen or so arms control agreements. In more recent times, when Dmitry Medvedev was in charge in Russia, there were much cooperation between Obama and him on nonproliferation, on counterterrorism, on blocking the sale of a very advanced air defense system to Iran. So I think the possibilities for engagement are, I'm more sanguine than Mattis is. But, you know, I do agree that Putin has indulged in certain activities that call for a tougher sort of containment than we've had to muster in recent years.
Here's another Mattis clip. This, I think, also came out of the discussion about the Iran nuclear deal, where if Trump seems like somebody with his America First policy, who, you know, for whom that translates to America's going to go it alone, listen to what Mattis said about that.
In addition to ensuring collaboration across government and the adoption of an integrated strategy, we must also embrace our international alliances and security partnerships. History is clear. Nations with strong allies thrive, and those without them wither.
Fred, that was a pretty interesting endorsement of the importance of allies.
Right.
Was that in
well,
the context of not just walking away from the Iran nuclear deal, which is not just between the United States and Iran, that's between a number of countries in
right.
Iran.
That was in the context of everything. Mattis has always been very keen on allies. He said in the hearing that the wars that he's fought in have always been with allies. He's never gone to an all-America military operation. And I think that this you would find this attitude to be the case among, again, with the exception of Michael Flynn, just about every active duty or recently retired American general. They realize that in the current world, the United States has limited leverage to get a lot of things done without allies. This is one reason why I think, and this is why the Senate was so keen to endorse Mattis, despite the fact that he's a military officer, is because they see him as a bulwark against the more skittish and compulsive tendencies of President-elect Trump and some of those around him in the White House.
And listeners, if you have any comments or questions about the national security nominees confirmation hearings for Fred Kaplan from Slate, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You mentioned Mattis as kind of a hedge against Flynn, the national security advisor to Trump, who's seen as such a wild card. But they have something in common. Weren't both Mattis and Flynn fired by President Obama for policy differences?
Flynn was fired. Mattis, Yeah, I guess you could say he was fired. His term ran out a little earlier than was scheduled. Flynn was fired simply for creating a complete mess and dysfunction within the Defense Intelligence Agency, which he was a director of at the time. He was had an authoritarian leadership tendency. Some of his intelligence findings that he was trying to push on his subordinates, for example, that Iran was involved in the attack on Benghazi, were just beyond the pale, and he was fired by both the Secretary of Defense and the director, the National Director Intelligence Director. And, you know, as one former senior intelligence official told me, you've got to work really hard to get both the SecDef and the Director of National Intelligence upset. They're not interested in confrontation of this sort. Mattis, it's always been a little bit unclear to me why he was cut short. I think a lot of it has to do with his continued aggressiveness toward attempts to try to ease tensions with Iran. He, like many people who fought in Iraq, is very suspicious of anything that Iran promises to do, and because Iran, you know, was involved in sending over a lot of its militia to kill American soldiers in Iraq during the Iraq War. But yeah, he's also, as you played in that clip, much as he's suspicious about Iran and also doubts whether they'll abide by the nuclear deal, they've abided so far. And while he would be in favor of getting more aggressive in monitoring Iran's behavior, he thinks it's silly and counterproductive to actually just rip up the Iran deal, which he also knows might not even have that much effect, since, as you noted, there are five other of our allies who signed that same deal.
So even though they were both in effect fired by Obama, you don't see Mattis and Flynn as a united front.
It sounds
like you still see Mattis as a sensible, feet on the ground, head on his shoulders hedge against Flynn's wilder tendencies.
Yes.
All right. Another clip, though, with respect to General Mattis, Senator Gillibrand from New York, who was concerned about some of the diversity issues within the military.
Do you believe that allowing LGBT Americans to serve in the military or women in combat is undermining our lethality?
Frankly, Senator, I've never cared much about two consenting adults and who they go to bed with.
So the answer is no?
Senator, my concern is on the readiness of the force.
So Senator Gillibrand with General Mattis. But Fred, hasn't Mattis spoken in the past about his unhappiness with using the military for social experiments, as I think he's put it?
Yes. In fact, the Marines have always been more critical than the other branches when it comes to putting women in combat roles, and gays as well. They are suspicious of the view that, oh, well, don't worry, we're not going to lower standards. They suspect that standards will be lowered to allow some unqualified people in the ranks. But now Mattis did say, with sort of a reluctant tone, that he's not going to revisit these issues. He's not going to relitigate this. As long as everything is going fine, he's not going to upset the way things are going. So, in fact, somebody even put him right on the line. He goes, is there anything about women or gays that you think would reduce the lethality of a unit? And he said no. So, you know, I think he's willing to let that one be bygones. There was another element of tension in that exchange. Gillibrand was the first senator to come out and say that she is not going to vote to give Mattis a waiver on this question of whether a recently retired military officer can be Secretary of Defense. And in fact, she wound up being one of three senators on the panel to vote not to give him a waiver, the others being Elizabeth Warren and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
And is he going to undo President Obama's policy of allowing women to fight on the front lines in combat if they're qualified?
He said that he would not.
Kevin in Chelsea has a Mattis question for you. Kevin, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering what you thought of the fact that after Mattis met with the Senate, he was planning on going to speak to Congress.
To the
House. And Congress was very upset that they told him that he wasn't going to go.
He canceled a House hearing. Now, of course, it's only the Senate that has the official power to confirm him. But
yeah,
there was going to be something with Mattis in the House, and he pulled out. Do you know what that's about?
Well, I looked into that, although not deeply. There was supposed to be a meeting with House people about the waiver issue. But as you said, it's only the Senate that actually confirms nominees. I was told that, a lot of people, House Democrats in particular, were upset by this. But I was also told that there was never really any plan for him to have a meeting with the House at this point in any event. So I was told, even by someone who is very reluctant to give him a waiver, that this has been overblown, that it's not really a big deal.
Let me play a couple more clips that seem to indicate that some of these nominees are not going to slavishly follow the whims of President-elect Trump, or at least will talk back to him on some of the more controversial or, to many people, outrageous things that he has said on the campaign trail. Here is Senator Dianne Feinstein asking a question of the CIA director nominee, Mike Pompeo.
If you were ordered by the president to restart the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation techniques that fall outside of the Army Field Manual, would you comply?
Senator, absolutely not. Moreover, I can't imagine that I would be asked that by the president-elect or then-president.
And that was a pretty striking hearing in general with Mike Pompeo, given the conflict right now between President-elect Trump and the CIA and intelligence community in general, don't you think?
Yeah, and the Pompeo hearing was I don't know how to read this, because Pompeo is a guy who in the past has said that we need to go back into the business of enhanced interrogation. He says that he can't imagine Trump asking him to do so. Well, I mean, it's not that difficult to imagine, given that on the campaign trail anyway, Trump said several times that he would bring back waterboarding and worse, and that even after, in a meeting, General Mattis told him that he's actually not a big fan of torture, that he can get more results out of a detainee with a pack of cigarettes and a couple of beers. He still said that he hadn't changed his mind on the subject. He found Mattis's remarks very interesting, still hadn't changed his mind completely. So Pompeo is a weird situation. He talked a good game, but this is a guy who has been very adamant on the use of torture. He has also talked about wars in kind of the context of a holy war. He might very well just be trying to curry favor with the professionals in the intelligence community at the CIA, because he must know that people who come into Langley from Capitol Hill in particular don't do very well with the professionals in the building.
Right.
He might just be, I don't know what he's doing. It was a very strange hearing, unlike Mattis and Kelly and some of the other people testifying, when they said things that conflict with some of the things Trump has said, at least were consistent with things that they have said in the past, whereas Pompeo was a departure all around. So wait and see is my attitude on that one.
That's pretty interesting and anxiety-producing. Here's another example of a nominee seeming to disagree with Trump. This is Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State nominee, seeming unequivocal that the United States should remain in the Paris Climate Accord.
I think it's important that the United States maintain its seat at the table on the conversations around how to address threats of climate change, which do require a global response. No one country is going to solve this alone.
What do you make of that one?
Well, the full scope of his remarks on climate change I actually found disturbing. First, he said we need to stay at the table. You know, we need to know what's going on. He didn't say that the United States would continue to lead on the issue. In fact, he declined to say yes to a question about that. When asked about his views of climate change, especially given ExxonMobil's history on this issue, he said, well, I do accept that greenhouse gas concentrations are man-made, but to what degree this changes things or what we should do about it are things that I still haven't made up my mind about. And then the most disturbing thing in the whole Tillerson hearing, and I found it very disturbing, he was asked about ExxonMobil lobbying against U.S. sanctions policies. And he said, oh, no, I've never lobbied that way, and the company has never lobbied that way. And then after the lunch break, Senator Menendez, New Jersey, came back with actual ExxonMobil lobbying statements in which it was very clear that they lobbied on 10 policies of the United States on sanctions. And then he said, well, do you know whether we lobbied for or against the sanctions? And Menendez just kind of smiled and said, I don't think you lobbied for sanctions. I mean, it shows, look, he was CEO of the company at the time. He was involved in lobbying against sanctions. He said, well, we were just trying to find out more information. And Menendez said, look, you don't need to fill out lobbying report just because you want to find out information. It says a lot about how honest this guy is going to be in dealing with the public, with the Congress. I was disturbed by Tillerson in general. I found his statements. I'd never seen him talk before. I'd never had any dealings with him. I was expecting, if nothing else, someone with kind of a sophisticated view of the world. To the extent that he talked about the nature of power in the modern world and American foreign policy, I found his views, his discussion, actually pretty shallow. I was taken aback by how unimpressed I was with this guy, actually.
And he admitted many times that he's just getting up to speed on these issues. He used that as a way to not answer questions.
But, well, you know, he was offered a briefing by the State Department, as people in his position often are, given the fact that, you know, yeah, you're coming in to be Secretary of State. It's a very big portfolio, and you have no expectations to be up to speed on a lot of this. And he declined the offer.
Huh. Last thing, and we have a minute. And this is the Homeland Security Secretary nominee, John Kelly. This is just a five-second clip of something that seems surprising on his face about a border wall.
A physical barrier in and of itself will not do the job. It has to be really a layered defense.
A layered defense. Is he talking about a physical layered defense,
no,
like a wall itself?
He's talking about dealing with the influx of drugs and things like that from well before you get to the border. Look, think about Kelly. He was commander of U.S. Southern Command. He's been dealing with these issues professionally for quite a while. And, he knows this is a complex problem that requires a multifaceted policy, and that physical barriers, as almost any military man will tell you, don't really do the job.
Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate. His books include Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War, very relevant to right now. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A lot more to come. Stay with us. Coming up next, a WNYC and The Intercept investigation
of people who are visitors to Rikers Island being strip searched. Stay with us.